Welcome to the Brilliant Business Moms Podcast, episode 64, with Sarah Kornack and Bethann Schwamberger. Today on the show, we're talking with Allison Fine. Allison is the author of 3 books on social media. Allison's books aren't about the nitty-gritty details of using social media, the how-to manuals of social media. Instead, her books are higher-level discussions about the power of using social media. So today on our podcast, we talked about her new book, Matterness, and we also had just kind of a higher-level, more philosophical-type discussion about social media, using it for good, and best practices for how companies should operate. I really like this episode and how Allison focuses on people and how much they matter and how much a company needs to value people. It's a great episode for kind of reframing your mindset. So let's get started.
You're listening to the Brilliant Business Moms Podcast, practical business advice for startup moms.
Today on the podcast, we are pleased to welcome Allison Fine. Allison is mom to 3 teenage boys and author of 3 books on social media. Her most recent book, Matterness, was released in November 2014. Welcome to the show, Allison.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Allison, can you start off by telling us a little bit more about yourself and how you got into this world of social media?
Sure. I was running a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. until 2001 when we moved up to New York, and I was looking for something different to do, and I saw this little article in the Washington Post. It was just a little blurb, and it said that the male legislature of Kuwait, all male, had just voted for full women's suffrage, the right to vote and the right to run for office. And I thought, well, that's just the oddest thing I've ever seen, right? This is way before the Arab Spring. So I dug into that a little bit more, and it turns out that one of the things that happened was that there were thousands of women who had bought Blackberries that spring, and beneath their burqas, they were emailing the legislature to vote for suffrage. And I thought, there is something really remarkable going on here with the movement of power from institutions to individuals because of social media. And I started to write about it then, and I haven't stopped since.
Have you always been interested in writing, or was that something new that developed after you heard about that remarkable story?
I never expected that I would be a full-time writer, but decided to try it. You know, my kids were younger, and I loved the opportunity to work from home. And as you well know, because of social media, we can be asynchronistic, meaning I can be working at midnight and don't need anyone to respond right at that minute. They can respond when their kids are napping. So it fit my timing, and it fit where I was in the world. And it turns out, hurrah, I think I'm pretty good at it. So it's all good.
That's wonderful. Can you share a few tips for small business owners out there, or even just moms who are wanting to make a difference in some way, on how they can use social media to do those things?
This is the perfect time. No other time in history could an individual, people like us, have the ability to create businesses or create a platform for themselves as a journalist or a writer because we have the social media toolset that enables us to do that right now. But there are a few ways of working that people who are, you know, individuals and trying to gather up eyeballs and buyers and donors need to start to think about. And I think the first thing, probably the most important thing, is to move from last century's broadcast models to this century's conversational models, right? So we were taught last century, if you're that old, which not everybody is, I understand, but we were taught that businesses, or people trying to create businesses, need to get their message out there and be plugging away at sending their messages at people, as if everybody's sitting on their couch waiting to be messaged, which certainly isn't true. And the idea now with social media is inherently conversational. The point is that one person says something and other people can respond. So from a business point of view, that means that people have to stop declaring their success and telling us how wonderful they are over and over again, and start getting in conversation with their own constituents and start asking them real questions. Because people out there, as you well know through your podcast, there are really smart people out there with great ideas who are goodwill, who want to help. And your goal as an entrepreneur right now is to plug into all of that good energy. And you can only do that through conversation. You can't do that through broadcast.
That, I know, is one of the main topics that you hit on in your book, Matterness.
Right.
Could you talk about a few of the other topics that you addressed in that book as well?
Sure. So I think of Matterness as the third book in a trilogy, right? When I first started to write about this 10 years ago, my first book, Momentum, was saying to organizational leaders, this stuff is coming. You know, this tool set is coming, and here's what it looks like, and here's how you need to begin to get ready for it. And the second book with Beth Cantor, the network nonprofit, was the fact that organizations that are immersed in social media start to act more like social networks than like standalone fortresses, is what we call traditional organizations. And this book says, look, 10 years into this transition, into this very disruptive moment, people need to matter more than they are right now. They started to matter. We could hear them, but organizations are working hard to keep a distance from them. So this moment in time requires a different kind of leadership, whether you're a blogger or whether you are organizing after school activities for your school, or whether you're starting a business or running a business. The idea of people needing to matter more in your ecosystem requires that you listen more than you speak, not something we were taught in graduate schools again. It means that you need to embrace your critics, which can be a really tough thing. You know, it's very easy when you're running a business and you're really impassioned about what you're doing to dismiss all critics as wackadoodles and wingnuts by definition. Not that there aren't wackadoodles and wingnuts out there, and I really like saying those words a lot, but a critic isn't by definition a wackadoodle. Mainly what they are people who want you to do better, right? They wouldn't take the time to criticize if they didn't want you to do better. And by dismissing them, people are missing a great opportunity to learn more about how to do better. And in fact, I think people need to engage their critics in public, right? When you go out, if somebody comes on your blog or on your Facebook page and says, I think you stink, the answer isn't, I think you stink. The answer is, tell me more. Tell me how. Tell me what I can do better. By doing that in public, you do a whole bunch of things. You allow other people who may be having the same problem to chime in civilly. You know, you can make those ground rules of how people can speak with you. But more importantly, you show the world you're not afraid of the critics and that you want to do better. And I think in a world that revolves around reputation building now, right, which is how we're all building our own platforms, showing the world that you embrace criticism, that you're not afraid of it, is a huge advantage for people. And another thing that I talk a lot about in the book is understanding that leadership now means working with crowds of people, not working with databases of people who are static and ready to do your bidding, because nobody is. So crowds can do a whole bunch of things. They can generate ideas. They can solve problems. They can connect you to their social networks. So learning how to figure out what to ask your crowd to do, how to be in conversation with your crowd, how to let people go and not feel bad about that. I know it can feel bad. But most of all, how to tap into the power of crowds is a really important leadership opportunity for people.
That's excellent advice. And, you know, speaking of this idea of working with a crowd and harnessing the potential that's there. I know you have a really interesting story of the voter initiative that you did with Twitter. Can you share a little bit more about that and how you use that concept of working with a crowd?
Sure. I love that story. It was 2008 in October, the end of the, you know, Obama's first election. And if you remember back to that, there was just a whole lot of energy in all the ecosystems about getting out the vote and so on. And a friend of mine, Nancy Scola, who worked at that time for Tech President, a blog, we were talking about the fact that there was a lot of talk at that time about voter suppression. And the traditional way that voter suppression works, sadly, that when people are lined up to vote and something is making it difficult to vote, whether it's on purpose or not, like very long lines, like machines that don't work, like ballots that are hard to understand, the only recourse for people would be to call a voter protection organization after they tried to vote, and then that group would file a lawsuit that would happen after election. It never changed an election. And Nancy and I thought, gee, what would happen if we took voter protection out of the hands of lawyers, which by definition has to be a good thing, and put it in the hands of voters by enabling them to use Twitter to tell the world in real time that something bad was happening, and then journalists and other people could shine a light on it. And at that time, 2008, Twitter was just starting its ascendancy. It wasn't close to getting the traction that it has now. So Nancy and I, just on a lark, wrote a blog post about it and said, hey, you know, what do y'all think about the possibility of using Twitter to protect voters next month? And we thought that was the end of the story. And then remarkably, the crowd of people who read the blog Tech President just started to chime in. And they said, you know, this is great. Let's build this thing. And over the next 30 days, we had dozens of people who were, you know, programming code and doing graphics and doing outreach to voter mobilization people and outreach to mainstream media. Nobody spent any money on this thing. We built an entire system. I think about 12,000 people used it that day to tell. And it was mapped online, and you could see in real time for the very first time in history where voters were having problems voting, according to voters, not according to newspaper people or lawyers, that somebody could tweet out, the line in St. Louis is outrageous. You know, why aren't they letting us vote over somewhere else? Or the machines in Brooklyn were broken. And it was the most remarkable experience I've ever had of a crowd self-organizing and putting all of their good energy and their great smarts to work on this wonderful effort. And then, as you might recall from the book, what was so wonderful about it was it was all open source software that was powering this Twitter vote report system. That software was then used by a group called Ushahidi to map out voter suppression efforts in Kenya, and has been used around the world ever since for natural disasters and other voter protection issues. So that code has had a whole sort of bouncing ball life of its own, helping people around the world. And we just all put that together in 1 month in 2008.
That's incredible. I love that story. And that's amazing that the software has gone on to help so many other people and so many other countries. Wow.
Yeah, I think it is about there are a couple of principles that I think are powering this particular moment in time. One is generosity and the other is abundance. The idea that there are lots of people who want to help, and that when you put good things out into the world, other people will help to grow and improve them. And those are expansive ideas, and when you can plug into them, whether it's in your professional life or in your personal life, it is the most empowering, positive feeling that you can get.
Do you have any practical tips for the very small business owner, the mom who's working out of her house trying to start a business? to harness the power of social media and start conversations and create movements. Do you have any advice for that woman?
I would point to Jennifer James, who is a mom blogger. And when she had her first child about 10 years ago, decided she really wanted to put her energy into blogging. But she realized after a little bit of time that being a blogger herself was not her best skill set. But what she was really good at was connecting mom bloggers to one another. And she asked her crowd of mom bloggers, hey, what do y'all think if we created a club, you know, an online space for us to learn from one another, connect with one another, help one another. So she created the Mom Bloggers Club. And after just 2 years or so, she had over 19,000 mom bloggers on her site. And then she thought, this is lovely and I really enjoy it, but I feel like we could have a greater purpose here. And she went out to her crowd and asked, is anyone interested if I started a site called Mom Bloggers for Social Good? And we could learn about causes that we're passionate about, like child hunger and healthcare. And 200 mom bloggers said, yeah, count me in. And so she started another site. And on that site, causes like UNICEF and brands like Procter & Gamble will come together and ask mom bloggers, help to educate mom bloggers, take them on trips around the world, help them to share, create awareness with their own readers. So what I learned from Jennifer was a few things that I think could help anybody who's in their house and has an idea and wants to do something. One is to remember that you're not alone. I know it can feel lonely when you get up and you're just looking at your screen, but it's important to remember that there are people out there who want to help. Your job is to connect with them in real and authentic ways, not in astroturfing, artificial, fake ways, right? So a real way is, I have this idea, what do you think about it? A fake way is, I have the best idea in the world, send me money, right? That's not a real way of asking for help. So you need to be smart and open and vulnerable, right, by opening yourself up to input from people and really recognizing those people when they do help you. So if you have an idea, let's say you're starting an Etsy business, I think it behooves you to have a place, wherever that place is, Twitter, Facebook, blog, Instagram, whatever place is comfortable with you where you're connecting with like-minded folks, to be in conversation with them about what you're trying to do and what you need help with, right? And the help isn't just buy my product or send me money, which is too often the refrain we hear, which we just tune out now. The help is, how can I make this better? What do you know? Who do you know? How do you know that can help me to improve my efforts? So you need to be open to those ideas. You need to be vulnerable enough to recognize and humble enough that you can't possibly have all of the answers. And you need to be very grateful for the help, which means thanking people or overthanking them even profusely over and over again and in public of, gee, you know, Sally gave me a great idea. I'm so grateful that she was willing to spend the time to do that. Making sure that people feel heard that way is a huge part of matterness when people and organizations are coming together and making each other better. The last thing I would say for people who are starting their own effort, and I think this is really important, is we tend to overplan, right? You can get really paralyzed with, I need to have the perfect plan to move out into the world and do something. There is no such thing as a perfect plan. What you need to have is a good enough plan to get started. Like, I understand what I'm trying to do, who I'm trying to do it with, what success is going to look like, what some failure triggers are going to be. Failure trigger would be, you know, I've lost 10% of my business over the last month. And then you need to get started and you need to learn in real time. That to me becomes the difference between success and failure for a lot of people. The folks who feel like they have to have the perfect plan find it very difficult to go out into the world and get started. And that can be a real problem for folks. Does that make sense?
Definitely. I think those were great tips for anyone. I know Sarah and I certainly felt like when we started this podcast that it wasn't a perfect plan. We certainly were complete novices and felt like, well, we have this great idea. We've got somewhat of a plan. Let's do it. And, you know, from there you do, like you said, you listen to others. You get their feedback. You get advice and help from others, and you thank people along the way. We certainly are grateful for the help of many, many people. So,
was it Pat Flynn who, I think I heard it on Pat Flynn, he was like, if you are completely satisfied with the first thing you put out, then you waited too long to put it out there, or something like that.
Yeah, I think,
like, you should cringe at your first things that you put out there to the world. Because, you know, you need to get it out there sooner than later. And if you don't cringe at your first attempts, then you probably waited too long or overplanned what you put out there.
See, wouldn't that be a great book title of Make It Cringeworthy?
That's true.
There you go.
So speaking of your books, Allison, I'm curious, with your intelligent, great take on social media, how does that impact the way you market the books that you sell?
That's a great question. So I had a commercial publisher for my first two books and decided that that wasn't a great model for me because they move at analog speed, which is pretty slow. And I have to do my own marketing anyway, you know, for the kinds of books that I write. So I actually created a publishing company for this book called Legacy Books. And I made myself the queen of Legacy Books. Okay, technically the CEO, but I like queen better. And I need to practice what I preach every day. I need to connect with people and talk to them about what I'm trying to do and learn from them and ask them how I can do this better and ask them for help. So somebody tweeted yesterday that she loved my book, which was lovely. So thankful for that. She's at United Way in Seattle. And I thanked her and then asked her who else I could talk to in Seattle. So it's just a constant iterative process of learning and engaging and thanking, as you just said, and trusting the generosity of my readers out there, which is just enormously fulfilling. And there is absolutely no other time in history where I could be doing what I'm doing right now in creating my own content and marketing it, mainly online, which is where I live. Because then I don't have to get dressed, right? Which would be just horrible.
Allison, you mentioned that when you were writing your first book that your sons were still fairly little. So how did you manage to do that, have young sons and you're writing a book? How did you manage to get that done?
I have to tell you, my oldest son's, his recollection of my writing that first book was a lot of yelling. I don't remember it quite that way, but he does. So I have always been enormously fortunate to have a lot of help. One of the reasons why we moved from D.C. to New York is I'm from here and my parents live nearby. So I've always had that great good fortune. For me, writing just suited my need to be flexible as well. So I could write early in the morning before the boys were up. I could edit at night, and I could work largely around their schedule. So that's always been a blessing to me.
Good help is extremely important, especially when you're tackling a big project and new project. So that's great that you could rely on help during that time.
Well, and yes, and in addition, I'm an imperfectionist. I have never felt a need to try to be a perfect mom. I'm aiming for somewhat good. So, you know, housework and things, it doesn't bother me, you know, that there are literally right now, you know, dishes in the sink. And I talk to so many women who get so caught up in worrying about, are they good enough as a mom? And it's unanswerable, and it kind of breaks my heart that they feel inadequate for it when they're perfectly fine in what they're doing.
That's a good point, and I think you're right, is there's no perfect mom. And so you just you just do your best and you pick those things that are important to you and kind of leave the rest. And I know Sarah and I are right there with you on the housework piece. I mean, I've actually been meaning to post some photos of my house on social media for a while just to say, hey, this is what doesn't get done when I'm working on the podcast or, you know, blogging is sometimes there's way too many dishes or, you know, a pile of laundry hanging around. So.
Well, and that's just it. And my concern is that my boys will grow up and I won't have any excuse anymore for the fact that nothing gets done around the house. But I think, as I mentioned to you before, you know, I've got three teenage sons, and I just think of it as parenting at volume. You just have to be really loud with boys, and it all works out just fine. They're still here, right?
So, Allison, do you have either a favorite business book or a quote that you live by, or perhaps both?
So my favorite book of the last few months isn't so much a business book, but it is just a great life book. It's Overwhelmed by Bridget Schultz. She's a writer at the Washington Post, and she's like us. You know, she's got her kids, and she's running around. You know, Bridget's life is a little bit more stretched because she's still in the office at the Washington Post writing. But what I loved most about the book is that it really punctures a lot of the conventional wisdom about work that I really appreciate, and it's so in keeping with the work I've been doing for the last 10 years. The conventional wisdom of things like the need of so many bosses to watch people work as opposed to focus on what they produce. You know, so the idea that unless somebody is sitting at that desk next to you for 8 straight hours with very few breaks, nothing productive has happened. The idea that people need to be always on is so counterproductive and so exhausting. The idea that not having a good, fulfilled private life, you know, and family life isn't central to a person's well-being. You know, she punctures all of those myths. And I just think it's beautifully written, and it's so powerful that she gets into real businesses. We're called Menlo Software in Minnesota, where you come and go as you please, you take vacation when you want, and they are super successful and super productive. And again, to me, it is undoing all of the artifice from last century, you know, the kind of organizational man idea of last century that organizations are these fortress-like hierarchies and people have to come to work. Now it's no longer 9 to 5. It's like 7 to 10 at night. And work a certain way is so out of step with humanity and with what we're able to do with our new tool set. So I just love the fact that she's put that book out there and really it's a wonderful work of art.
It is exciting to see how businesses are working in different ways, or at least some businesses are, and making a much better and productive work environment for their employees. I know you talked about what you called the churn in your book, Matterness, which kind of relates to that topic. Could you talk about that a little bit more?
Sure. So, you know, there are just shelves and shelves of books on the idea of how to make, you know, the importance of making people matter to organizations, and there are fancy consultants all over the place making a gazillion dollars saying the same thing. Oh, and as a quick aside, here is an experience I had the other day with Verizon. My internet was out, and I scheduled a service call and called at 9 in the morning and found out from them that they would be here to fix my problem sometime before 8 p.m., which seemed to me kind of a big window to spend waiting in my house for them. So I did what I do. I took to Twitter and said, you know, at Verizon, seriously, you can't give me a smaller window than that. And in 2 seconds had somebody from Verizon take my information and come back to me and say, yeah, they'll be there at 3 o'clock. And I said, why couldn't they tell me that on the phone? And they said, they don't have access to that information. I said, well, why do you do? And he said, because we deal with the escalated problems. I said, in other words, you get loud, cranky people, and the phone people are the ones who are making us loud and cranky, right?
Yeah.
So the idea in that ecosystem of Verizon is that their internal systems, right, their way of organizing themselves, the way of protecting themselves from the world outweighs making people, customers, feel like they matter. All of that stuff internally is what I call the churn. And the churn is what is making organizations tone deaf to how they feel to people on the outside. And it's just endemic to organizational life. It just happens over and over again. And you can see it in every staff meeting that happens, where the majority of time is spent about on internal process, on the fear of what could go wrong out there, just an enormous amount of time spent on anything that could possibly go wrong. People playing devil's advocate, which is a role I just hate. It is so de-energizing. And organizations quickly lose sight of what it feels like for people to engage with them, because the internal stuff, the churn, just takes over. And it just happens all the time. You can see it all the time in organizations that you come into a store that doesn't greet you, the worst are the doctor's offices, right, where clearly your insurance card is far more important than you are as a person in your first engagements with the office.
Yes.
Right? So there's a way out of the churn. And the way out of it is to focus on, is to have leaders focus more on principles than on plans, right? You have to be organized around something. And that something can't be your plans, because when plans are driving how you're organized internally, that is churn bait. That is what creates the churn, right? Is that I have to get something done by a certain time or the sky is going to fall. When you're organized around principles, and the Container Store does a beautiful job of this, right? When your principles are the people out there matter a lot. We care about them, right? They're our first concern. Then you can get out of the churn. Then you can organize your work around making sure that you're in conversation with people every day, that you're listening to people, that you're speaking with them and not out at them. And to me, that is just if anybody takes anything away from my book, Matterness, it is the idea that the churn is man-made, it's artificial, and it can be reversed.
I love that. And when you mentioned doctor's offices, Allison, I used to be an RN, and I've worked in both a clinic and a hospital setting, and I've seen that so often, that focus on the internal and the organizational structure versus what really matters, which are the people that we're serving
right.
and we're helping.
You can see it. You walk into any doctor's office and the place is just overwhelmed with the paperwork and the insurance and the internal stuff, and you just feel like you don't matter at all, right?
Yes. Yes. And, you know, being on that side as a nurse, too, it's like my highest priority is my patients and helping them to be comfortable and answering questions and teaching and relieving those fears. But then there's all this, you know, the pressure of the paperwork and the surgeons who are mad about this or have some weird little idiosyncrasy here, or the other staff haven't been trained well enough to know to do this thing to support stuff, and it's a struggle. But that's a great point. The principle is that's what matters.
And this applies. Look, we can take all the big, you know, Verizons and doctor's offices, but I've seen, you know, the churn takes over, you know, the one person business as well. It is just endemic to work. And I think it's a very human reaction of, you feel so much pressure to do things and to succeed, and those pressures take over your whole being. And it's very hard to reverse that. It's very hard to recognize that, gee, people on the outside don't really care about your problems so much, and you're making it so much worse by trying to force your problems on them, right? I just want to ask every doctor's office in the country if they could just thank me for being a patient. Right? For any of us being their patients, it will go so far to making us feel better about them.
So that's so true. And I, being on this side as a patient, and I have a son who has some different medical needs, and, you know, what I've realized too is that I'm your customer. I can choose to take my business elsewhere, and I've chosen to do so on many different occasions. And I'm lucky that, you know, we have insurance that lets us do that and is accepted, is widely accepted by different doctors, but it is different what the mentality is when a surgeon realizes that I can go pick another surgeon like that and they're gone. Then they start bending over backwards to see how they can win us back. And it's just like, no, that you have it wrong. You should have been, like you said, you should have been thanking us from the beginning for choosing to be your patient. So,
right. Sorry, it's a combination of overwhelmedness by the bureaucracy and arrogance that goes into a system like that.
As we wrap up this interview, which has been very informative, I'm very glad we got a chance to talk with you. Do you have any fun mom moments that you've had recently with your three teenage boys?
I'll tell you a story about how my middle son has mattered in the world recently. How does that sound?
Sure.
So my middle son is 16, and he is spending his fall semester of junior year of high school in Israel for 6 months. And he is a singer. He's an opera singer. And his program went to the Western Wall in Jerusalem a few weeks ago for Sabbath services because they knew that the women of the wall were going to be there. That's a group that has been trying to get equal rights for women to pray at the wall in the same way that men are allowed to. And they showed up for services, and there's a women's section of the wall, and then there's a little fence that you can see through, and then observers can stand behind that. And my son Zach went to the front where observers were and stood on a chair because there were concentric circles of women where they were having their service. And they created concentric circles because they were preparing to do the first bat mitzvah for a girl at the wall in 5,000 years. And nobody knew this. It was a secret. So Zach stood on the chair and he started to sing to support the women because he it was really important to him. And the women of the wall heard him sing, and one of them came over, handed him a hearing aid, and said, "Put this in so you can hear us better because you're now the leader of the men." And Zach started to sing to lead the men in support of the women. And he said it was the best day ever. He got to sing out loud. He got to support a bat mitzvah, which is very important to him. And he got to use his voice for good. And I was just so proud of him in that moment. He actually wrote it up as a story. So I think I'm, so proud of all my boys in that they know how to use their voices for justice and are willing to do so. And I don't know anything that could make a mom prouder, huh?
That's wonderful. I love the way that, they're clearly learning that from you, so.
And probably the yelling part, too.
Using their voices loudly, yes.
You gotta be heard, right?
So, Allison, where are the best ways that our listeners can find you and learn more about you?
Well, certainly on Twitter, AFine. Be happy to have anybody follow me and friend me there. And on my website, www.allisonfine.com.
Great. Fantastic. Thank you so much for talking with us today, Allison. Really learned a lot.
My pleasure.
What a good reminder that episode was that no matter how big your business is, whether it's small or gigantic, that focusing on people and valuing them makes such a big difference. It's so important. And I thought Allison really conveyed that message today, and I was so glad we had the chance to talk with her about that. I don't know if you remember, but during the podcast episode, Allison mentioned a story about a woman who said, "Oh, I loved your book." And Allison said, "Thank you so much. Do you know anyone else that I could talk to about my book?" Well, after our interview was over, kind of after the recording had stopped, Allison took her own advice about just asking people for help. So Allison just asked us, "Do you know another podcaster that I could talk with?" And also, is there anything I could do to help you? Honestly, nobody else had asked us these questions before, and it was kind of neat. Well, we thought about her question, and we actually did know a podcaster, Jessica Rhodes, who we had interviewed previously. So we introduced them, and Allison wrote back later to say they recorded an episode together. I just thought that was a really neat story that happened kind of off camera, so to speak, or off audio, where she talked about that advice in the podcast, just asking for help. And then she took that advice and it worked out for her. She got another podcast interview. We are not normally that bold. We don't go around asking other people for help. But I think that advice is fantastic, and I really want to try and do that more often when people say they like something I'm doing, to say thank you. Do you know anyone else? And how can I help you? Such simple advice, but it really panned out. And in the spirit of Allison's fantastic advice, if you liked this episode, I would like to say thank you. Thank you for listening to our podcast episodes. It really means a lot to us that you're tuning in, you're listening, and hopefully you're getting some great advice and information out of each one. We're really striving to produce the best show that we can. And so, if you did like this episode, I would like to ask for your help. Is there one person that you could maybe tell about our podcast? If so, thank you. That would be fantastic. If not, no problem. We just appreciate your listening ears. And if there's anything we can do to help you, feel free to drop us an email and we'll do the best that we can. If you're looking for the show notes, head on over to brilliantbusinessmoms.com/64. Now it's your turn to head out there and be brilliant.